The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, March 2018, Volume 20, Number 3. This is the first of five installments of the March issue. Oprah shares this month's cover with Mindy Kaling and Reese Witherspoon. The three of them stand out in their black and white dresses against the rose beige background. The big headline is, "Where do we go from here?" What we know for sure, things between men and women will never be the same. The big black O for Oprah sits on a white rectangle in the upper left-hand corner of the cover. And when we open the cover, we have a series of ads for Talbots, the Oprah magazine collection for Talbots. The first one shows Connie Britton sitting on a red stool against a red, white, and blue drapery, and she's wearing a navy gingham button top that's gathered a little bit at the neck, and just above the elbow, the three-quarter length sleeve has about an 8-inch ruffle that gives it a bell shape, and it ends in a scallop design a few inches above the wrist, and the scallop design is trimmed in red. She wears that tucked into a navy miniskirt that has ball fringe finishing the hem. And then there's a red, white, and blue scarf that's been tied at the waistline to give it some extra snazz. And she's wearing some white sneakers with a big silver star on each one. So let's look behind the scenes. The Talbots takeover. For a third year, O has collaborated with one of our favorite retailers to create cute clothes for a cause. Just in time for spring, the O, the Oprah Magazine collection for Talbots, is here. And what better way to spotlight the classic yet fun pieces than with five shining stars as models? Connie Britton, Sophia Bush, Tanika Ray, Yvette Nicole Brown, and Busy Phillips. We're thrilled to get behind the charitable initiative. A portion of the proceeds goes to Dress for Success, and the photo shoot was a love fest. Their energy was infectious, as O Creative Director Adam Glassman continuing to say, they're super passionate about helping women. We have a picture here of the photographer jumping up in the air to take a picture of Miss Britton and Sophia Bush. Leaping lenses, it reads, photographer Chris Kramer goes high for a shot of Britton and Bush. And then we have another snapshot here of Busy Phillips with the beloved ladybug clutch. So she's holding up this cute little plain clutch, zippered across the top, navy blue and white horizontal stripes. They're about half-inch stripes. It has this massive ladybug on the front of it. And then we have other snapshots of Adam with some of the models, Glassman with Ray and Brown, and then the next snapshot is makeup artist Jesse Yarborough touches up Brown before a take, and then finally at the bottom, Glassman and Bush stay coordinated. They are both wearing navy blue tops with red and white trim. Now, our model is wearing a navy blue top that has red ladybugs on it. And then here we have Tie One On. This little silk scarf brings together all the elements of the collection, gingham, stripes, and ladybugs, in the most versatile way. So the majority of the long, slender scarf is red with little ladybug patterns on it, and the very ends have navy blue and white stripes in varying widths, with the widest stripe in the middle having, it looks like little stars, or maybe that's a gingham design. It's a little hard to tell in the picture. Okay, so step one, you can knot it around your neck. It's slim, so there's no folding. You can just wrap it around your neck and tie it. Here's a second option. For a softer take on a bracelet, wrap it around your wrist. And the third option, add fun flair to your purse by winding it around the strap. Let's move now to Here We Go with Oprah. We have another picture of Oprah with Reese and Mindy. They're against that same sort of rose blush beige background, and this time they're wearing lighter, paler sort of rose blush pink outfits. Oprah says, "The last several months have been a doozy, right? Nearly every day, new revelations that men we've respected and admired, men whose work has moved, entertained, and informed us, are not the men we thought they were. And in the wake of their abuses, a trail of women who are scared, exhausted, hurt, and angry. And now, what? What's next? Where do we go from here?" Answering that question starts with trying to understand the male psyche, the better to address the conflict and darkness that may lurk within. This month, we're diving deep into this cultural moment, teasing out what we need to know about gender, power, and how we treat and mistreat each other. I also tackled the topic with two of the strongest, boldest women I know, my A Wrinkle in Time co-stars Mindy Kaling and Reese Witherspoon. You'll be enthralled by their thoughts on this never more pressing topic. Because calling out hideous behavior can take us only so far. Eventually, we have to take a step into the light. Oprah. Before we get into the feature article this month, let's look at the gratitude meter in the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. So we start out with five things we're applauding this month, and they go from awe to awesome. So starting at awe, life imitates art is the first item. Matchy Matchy is A-OK with Stefan Drashen. The photographer strolls through museums to capture serendipitous moments when viewers mirror the masterpieces they're admiring. Appreciate his still life images at peoplematchingartworks.tumblr.com. And so we have a picture in a gallery here, and it is a modern piece, a large canvas that is beige on the bottom, but when you get really close to the top, there's a bit of a diagonal line that's white, sort of wavy on the top of the white stripe, if you will, and then the very top of this canvas is black. So we're looking at the back of a woman who has a headset on, like you get in museums, and she's listening to probably a description of this piece of artwork. And she's wearing a black top that has this little white color blocking couple of inches on the very top of it. So you get the same sort of color scheme, if you will. Now we move to the next item. Very small print is what it's called. The dollhouse, built in the early 1920s for Queen Mary, is full of tiny charms, a wine cellar, running water, and a newly discovered stamp-sized story written by Vita Sackville West, specifically for the Miniature Homes collection. A note of explanation follows the hijinks of an ageless sprite and may have inspired her lover Virginia Woolf's novel Orlando. We have a picture here of the dollhouse and a hand holding up the teeny tiny book between its thumb and forefinger. In the middle, giving voice. Chameleon-like performance artist and playwright Anna Deavere Smith's new one-woman show turned HBO special, Notes from the Field, examines through a series of stirring monologues the conditions that push young folks of color out of school and into prison. And you might remember Anna Deavere Smith from the Showtime series Nurse Jackie. She played the boss. I don't know if she was a hospital administrator or head of the emergency department. But there is a picture here of her. And next we have a bunch of green bananas. And it says, "Thanks a bunch. Knock, knock, who's there? Pro-vitamin A rich banana. Researchers at Queensland University of Technology in Australia have spent the past decade developing a fortified version of the fruit that could eventually be grown in areas where children suffer from vitamin A deficiencies. First test site, Uganda. Peel us in. And now we're at Awesome. Sisters Act. March is Women's History Month, so polish up your bell hooks pin, finalize your Feminism 101 playlist, Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me, check, and take time to salute female icons of the past, present, and future. And shown here we have Billie Jean King playing tennis, Rosie the Riveter with her arm, you know, showing her muscles. And now let's look at the photo that comes with Live Your Best Life each month. It's a big photograph that covers the entire page, and we have a quote. Let me describe the photo. We're in a park, and it's full of people in the foreground. The sun appears to be setting in the background and shining through the trees. There's a band playing. Acoustic, couple of acoustic guitars, maybe a keyboard, maybe a violin here. It's a little hard to see through all the people just out partying on a summer day, having a lot of fun. And they're kind of in a circle in the foreground, and they are dancing, and they have their arms stretched out. They're forming like a chain. Each person has their hands on the shoulders of the people on either side of them. And here's the quote from Lindy West. We're all building our world right now in real time. Let's build it better. And still in Live Your Best Life, we have an article entitled Brave New Worlds. Oprah, Mindy Kaling, Reese Witherspoon, this starry trio beams into movie theaters March 9th when Disney's A Wrinkle in Time premieres. Here's the scoop on a space odyssey like no other. Imagine the most iconic science fiction film directors, and names like Stanley Kubrick, Steven Spielberg, and George Lucas probably spring to mind. Now, there's an exciting new member of the fantasy faction, Ava DuVernay, the visionary force behind March's big screen saga, A Wrinkle in Time. Adapted from Madeline Lingle's 1962 book of the same name, the movie is about a girl, Meg Murray, who hops through time to rescue her dad from an evil, universe-threatening force. DuVernay says, quote, the book is a tapestry of spirituality and self-empowerment, but to then take those elements into the realm of fantasy, I couldn't believe such an opportunity was mine, end of quote. That disbelief was justified. The stubborn and shrewd Meg, played by newcomer Storm Reid, might belong in the company of other female dystopian legends like Ellen Ripley and Katniss Everdeen, but the film worlds those women inhabit are almost always crafted by men, and white men at that. DuVernay says, quote, I knew that as a black female director, my rendering of fantasy would be different. I look at Ridley Scott's The Martian and think, okay, that's one way to portray a planet. But I had to push beyond what other films had done. End of quote. For DuVernay, part of the push meant shattering perceptions of what superheroes look like. Enter Oprah, Mindy Kaling, and Reese Witherspoon, who play a squad. Mrs. Witch, Mrs. Who, Mrs. Watsit, of sage cosmic custodians who protect Meg during her journey. DuVernay says, quote, in the book, the Mrs. are described as three little old ladies, end of quote. In the movie, they embody different races, sizes, and cultures, all while decked out in extravagant ensembles. And while Lingle's decision to make her protagonist a bespeckled tween girl was bold, DuVernay took things a step closer. She says, quote, the first order of business was making Meg biracial. Viewers who live in households with folks of different hues should be able to enter the film, too. When you're dealing with fantasy, storytellers have no excuse not to embrace new visions, end of quote. Quantum meet. Leap. There's a picture at the top of the page in which we're looking at kind of a big sky and in the foreground a wheat field. And we have Mindy Kaling, Oprah, and Reese Witherspoon dressed as their characters in the middle of this wheat field. Mindy Kaling, Mrs. Who, Oprah, Mrs. Witch, and Reese Witherspoon, Mrs. Watsit, are the galactic guardians who guide A Wrinkle in Time's heroine, Meg Murray, on her epic travels. Then down below, we have a snapshot of Ava DuVernay on a hillside in New Zealand, where much of the film was shot. And she says, "Beautiful isn't even the word to describe this country." And when we turn the page, we have several pictures from this film, sort of behind-the-scenes pictures, because we see the cameramen and the light filters and the microphones. So above, a picture of Oprah in her very futuristic costume and blonde large wig standing beside Miss DuVernay. Oprah says, "I loved playing the wisest character." This drew her upon her news anchoring days to give Mrs. Witch her deep, commanding voice. Oprah goes on to say, "Wise people never have to raise their voices. There was a scene where Chris Pine, who plays Dr. Murray, wanted me to become agitated, and I told Ava, 'Mrs. Witch doesn't get agitated. When you've been around for millennia, there's no need.'" And to the right, we're in this wheat field, and we have Reese Witherspoon in a long red wig and a white ruffled outfit, and all the cameramen around her. Reese, as Mrs. Watsit, in a scene with Derek McCabe, who plays Meg's little brother, Charles Wallace. Reese says, quote, "Madeline Lingle's book is about what's possible. It seems appropriate to be talking about it right now because it asks, how do we become warriors for good in the world?" End of quote. Now we have another snapshot. We're on the edge of a lake with mountains in the background in New Zealand. In this snapshot, the crew setting up near Lake Hawea in central Otago, New Zealand. DuVernay says, quote, "During the first scouting trip, we flew all over in a helicopter, and I'd look down, point at interesting things, and then we'd land. And after walking around, I'd either go, it doesn't look as good from the ground, or this place is incredible. Put it on the list." And then to the left, we have a picture of Storm Reid, 14, as the movie's world-saving middle schooler, Meg Murray, with Levi Miller, who plays Meg's fellow time traveler, Calvin. And they're in sort of a forest with sunlight shining in the background. Now, our next picture is of Oprah in her futuristic costume and that blonde wig, and she's got her eyes closed, and she's standing with Reese Witherspoon on one side, Mindy Kaling in the other, and they are in costume. They are standing with their eyes closed, and they are clutching each other's hands. Mindy, Oprah, and Reese share a serene moment. Not that it was always quiet on the set. The threesome's shared trailer positively thrummed with conversation. Oprah dryly says, quote, "Mindy and Reese are two of the chattiest people I've ever known." Reese confirms, "If you came into the trailer at 5:30 in the morning hoping for a little bit of silence, absolutely not happening." Oprah says, "I've learned to enjoy the talk. I got into its rhythm." Below, we have a snapshot of Oprah with costume designer Paco Delgado standing by. She's in this sort of bronzy, silvery outfit, and she's having the costume adjusted. And then there is a picture of DuVernay with Chris Pine, who is Dr. Murray, Meg's lost in space dad, and they're just looks like they're talking over the script. We have a quote here from Oprah. "This film's message, everyone has the power to be a carrier of light." And we have this quote from Reese Witherspoon. "I've never seen a girl of color like Storm at the center of a giant film like this. It shows so many other little girls they can be in their own adventure too." And now, when we turn the page, We have a snapshot of Oprah greeting the crew while shooting a scene on the planet Orion, home to a seer known as the Happy Medium, played by Zach Galifianakis, who lives in a cave. The cast had to walk on massive scaffolding like the cross-like structure behind Oprah. Hence, the wire rig attached to her costume for balance. And then left, we've got Oprah in this wheat field. Oprah's ensemble for the planet Kamazots. Says Delgado, I saw Mrs. Witch as a kind of energy. She's a star in the sky. I wanted her costumes to play with the ideas of metal and light. And then here's a snapshot of the cast and crew outside of costumes and their street clothes. The cast and crew spent 2 weeks filming on the South Island of New Zealand. Oprah says, quote, I couldn't keep up with Mindy and Reese there. They told me first we're going to a yoga place, and then we're taking a helicopter, and then we're hiking, and then we're going on a boat ride. They squeezed all the juice out of that orange. And our Best Life celebrity this month is from A Wrinkle in Time, Storm Reid. And here's our tween girl in a gray t-shirt and her hair pulled up tight and a little bun on the top of her head. And she's got on some kind of heavy black glasses. The ascendant adolescent on the importance of Oreos and embracing your power. Best pinch me moment, booking the role of Meg Murray. After an audition process that took about a month, my agent finally told my mom to expect one more phone call. We didn't know what was going on until Ava DuVernay called from an unknown number to say I'd gotten the part. Mind blown. Best advice, don't waste energy on things you can't change. Oprah told me that one day when we were having a conversation about my weird fear of being tall, I'm already 5'4", instead of putting negative energy out into the universe about something that's set in stone, like my height, she said I should turn that energy into something positive and use it to make my dreams come true. So if I end up being 7 feet, then I'll be 7 feet. Best on-set snack. I'm a cookie girl. They were in my trailer, at the catering table, everywhere. My favorite are mint Oreos, which nobody in my family likes, so I get to keep them all for myself. And finally, best reason to journey through time. To meet my ancestors. My mom just got a DNA kit, and now my sister and I want one too, so we can learn more about where we come from. It's kind of like time traveling. Let's move now to our feature article, Where Do We Go From Here? And it's in that special section of the magazine that is introduced each month with the creative folks at O coming up with some wonderful way to give us that Oprah O. And this month we have like a bonsai plant, or I think it's that Japanese art where you prune a small tabletop plant into a shape, and this one's in kind of a gray flat dish with moss in it, and these lovely twisting stems and branches with just a few bits of green foliage on it, and they're two of them on each side, and they kind of twist out and twist up to give us the Oprah O. March 2018. Headlines, allegations, falls from grace. It's been a gut-wrenching, eye-opening time, but a seed has been planted, and at this moment, there is a chance to cultivate a better world for working women everywhere. The year of big questions. Where do we go from here? In case you haven't heard, we've got a problem on our hands. Hands, in fact, are a major part of the problem. But in just a few months, we've made astonishing progress, sharing powerful stories, toppling powerful pervs. And now it's time to channel our outrage at the sexual harassment pandemic and figure out a righteous way forward. And like many of the special features each month, we have a series of contributions. And let's hear this first one from Rebecca Solnit. There is a stunning suddenness to these moments. Something that seemed immovable doesn't just move, but shatters. What seemed inevitable and eternal falls apart, explodes, and in an instant change is possible. But of course, even an earthquake isn't sudden. It's the result of tension built up over decades or centuries. So it was when apartheid ended in South Africa, when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Arab Spring broke out. So it was when Anita Hill testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1991 about being sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas. No, that did not halt his nomination, but it did revolutionize our understanding of sexual harassment. There was a crack produced by civil society pushing against injustices, by voices heroic enough to ring out even when winning was nowhere on the horizon. It's easy to say that a pair of articles revealed decades of monstrous behavior by one depraved Hollywood producer and frame it as though it all came out of the blue. But feminism had laid decades of groundwork, has evolved the culture to a point at which significant numbers of women are assignment editors, TV and movie producers, and legislators in charge of deciding what the story is and whose story matters. And because plenty of men have also been transformed by the work feminism has done, they are increasingly in the habit of listening to women and treating them as at least as credible as the men they accuse. I have watched this error unfold with both horror at the stories of violence and hate and joy that at last we are doing something about it. I have seen myriad small actions build a bridge, arching across the chasm to bring us into a new era. I have been moved to see women overcome shame and fear and defeat to break their silence. My grandmothers were born into a world that didn't let them vote. My mother's young adulthood took place at a time when marriage made a wife a husband's subordinate. I grew up in a better world, but still one that devalued women, often forcibly. When I look at my beautiful 10-month-old great-niece with her cloud of dark hair and wide eyes, I hope that we can do better for her. A deeply moving aspect of the recent revelations is the way women have come forward to support one another, to say this or that victim is not a liar, because this also happened to me, and neither of us wants it to happen to another, lifting each other up and holding one another's truths. That generosity toward strangers is already a triumph over the rigged value system from which predatory actions arise. One of the greatest dangers is that in resisting your enemy or defeating him, you become him. This is why, though punishment of sexual harassers may be necessary and appropriate, punitiveness and retaliation will not take us where we need to go. What will is ensuring that everyone has an equal voice. Bosses, interns, pants wearers, actors, farm workers, and that we hear one another. There will be more earthquakes. In between, we all can do the slow, subtle, crucial work of love and generosity and deepen the commitment to building a system, a society, a culture in which women are powerful, men are kind, and children are allowed to grow up whole and free. And here's a sidebar. It was locker room talk and other lies we should never fall for again. Remember when inappropriate was reserved for things like wearing flip-flops to the White House? Words such as misconduct and improper are a mixed blessing now that the news is teeming with salacious stories. They skirt the need to explain to small children what it means to whip it out, but using euphemisms, which make the awful sound innocuous, also allows human beings to rationalize bad behavior. Tom Page, Ph.D., a postdoctoral research associate at the University of Kent in England, who's studied sexual harassment, says, quote, "It's part of what psychologists call moral disengagement, cognitive strategies that let us bypass guilt or shame," end of quote. And euphemism isn't the only moral disengagement strategy that's come in handy lately. A few other popular mental acrobatics. Moral justification, rationalizing misbehavior as a bonding activity. Quote, news is a flirty business, end of quote. Geraldo Rivera commenting on the way beyond flirty allegations against Matt Lauer. Here's another one, distortion of consequences, failing to see what the problem is. Here's a quote from former Congressman Trent Franks, who asked two staffers if he could borrow their wombs for 9 months. Quote, I have broached a topic that, unbeknownst to me until very recently, made certain individuals uncomfortable. End of quote. The next one, displacement of responsibility, blaming the people in charge. And this from toxic, fabulist, and predatory ogre Harvey Weinstein. Quote, I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior in workplaces were different. That was the culture then. End of quote. We have a couple of more. The next one, advantageous comparison. Making the old, it could have been worse argument. And this from performance masturbator Louis C.K., quote, I said to myself that what I did was okay because I never showed a woman my blank without asking first, end of quote. And next, diffusion of responsibility, saying it's okay because other people do it. This is from Alabama State Auditor Jim Ziegler on why the claims against the allegedly teen-loving ex-judge Roy Moore are no biggie. Quote, Mary was a teenager and Joseph was an adult carpenter. They became the parents of Jesus, end of quote. Now, our next contribution is called Men Overboard, Terry Crews on how to save guys from themselves. I call masculinity a cult because it is. It's something you're indoctrinated into that blinds you to the truth. Growing up in Flint, Michigan, I remember asking friends how to talk to a girl I liked. I was told to lie to her, to keep her off balance. Having game was all about manipulating girls, getting them to give you sex, then tossing them aside. As a man, you're also taught to keep your girl in check, to maintain control. But you cannot control someone and love them at the same time. You only control things that are beneath you. I'm guilty, too. I was a card-carrying member of the cult of masculinity. I was addicted to pornography for years, and that impulse was fueled by the thought that I was more valuable than my wife. I and other young men in my community watched our mothers and sisters be abused, which taught us that we were worth more than the women in our lives. When my wife finally said she wanted out of our marriage, I remember, to heck with this, I'll just go get another woman. But a little voice inside me kept saying, maybe it's me. And I couldn't put that thought away. Once the egg got cracked, there was no putting it back together. I went to rehab 8 years ago, then did a 90-day sex fast. I wanted to take sex out of the equation to see my wife as a human being. Getting deprogrammed changed everything. Einstein pointed out that we cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them. We have to rise above that mindset. Even though we're trained not to admit it, men want intimacy, for someone to see us for who we are and love us regardless. But to get true intimacy, you have to be emotionally open. You have to be vulnerable. I'll spend the rest of my life making amends to my wife. Still, it's a joy to be out of that culture, and it feels good to speak out about the harassment I've faced, being groped by some Hollywood player. I see these men submerged inside this mentality, and I can only shake my head. They're in Guyana, sipping the Kool-Aid. I've been called a pussy, been told all your muscles are good for nothing. But the question isn't, how strong are you? It's, what is the real enemy here? The process of being deprogrammed is eye-opening. Once you call yourself on your bullshit, you start seeing it everywhere. And now, nobody can steal my joy. Our next item is called, Yes, Sex Addiction is a Thing, and No, It's Not an Excuse. A sex therapist explains. A sex addict engages in sex for the same reason an alcoholic drinks, to escape unpleasant feelings. Whether those stem from childhood trauma, anxiety, depression, or some other source, often the addict isn't even aware of them. All he's aware of is an overwhelming urge. In the moment, sex addicts are in an almost trance-like state. They feel as if their behavior is beyond their control, and often it escalates over time. They need to increase the activity to get the same high. Harassment is more deliberate. It's about one person exerting power over another. A powerful man may sexually aggress simply because he feels entitled to, but he may also be fulfilling a deep subconscious need, one that might have been established very early in life. For instance, a man who masturbates in front of women may be expressing a regressed part of himself. It's terrible for his victims, but you can imagine that little boy inside saying, "Look at me, am I the greatest?" Even someone who doesn't fit the definition of sex addict, but uses sex compulsively, can benefit from rehab if they're motivated to change. Just wanting the problem to go away isn't enough. A man has to break down the walls of denial and compartmentalization and see his actions the way the world does, to look at the pain he's caused and the ways he's disconnected from himself. One more thing, more people are seeking help now, and many patients want to work even harder. They're shaken. They see the situation from the outside and feel horrible for the victims. They say, "I don't want to be one of those guys." This is from Pooja Hall, a therapist at the New York Center for Sexuality and Sex Addiction Treatment. Excuse me. And next, we have a contribution from Gloria Steinem, feminist icon. In the 1970s, women students invented the term sexual harassment to describe what was happening to them in summer jobs, and Ms. Magazine wrote a cover story about it that was banned in supermarkets. Then the great feminist legal scholar, Catherine MacKinnon, incorporated the concept into sex discrimination law, and Anita Hill educated the country while facing down an all-male, all-white Senate Judiciary Committee. The really bad guys are still trying to destroy their accusers. Google Darvo, D-A-R-V-O, but the not-so-bad guys are saying they're sorry and changing. Since democracy begins with power over our own bodies, this moment could be huge. If we keep talking and listening and acting, we just might restore the truth that human beings are linked, not ranked. And we have a fold-out, which is a big, colorful, yellow map of the outline of the United States, and it has a series of quotes all the way across the page. Hashtag us too, the United Shame of America. This is a true story, 50 sentences long. Each sentence comes from a different woman. Each woman comes from a different state. Funny how it reads like they're all the same person, because in a way, they and we, all of us women, are. So I'll start reading all the way across the United States, starting up at the Puget Sound. I had a job at a great place I loved. It was one of the best working environments I'd ever experienced, except for one thing. And then we have a break denoted by it. A star. My boss, the owner's son. Star. Meaning now we're getting a quote from another woman. He would always get up from his desk, walk around behind me, and start rubbing my shoulders, which I rejected each and every time. Star. I noticed he always ended up wherever I was working that day. It became pretty clear he was following me around. Star. He had friended me on all the social media platforms and commented on my posts in a way that felt like an obsession. Star. He would ask me if I worked out and say he could tell that I did. Star. One of my coworkers said, "That could be sexual harassment," and everyone laughed. Star. I was forced to silently listen to my fellow female staff members being objectified, all the while wondering what was being said about me while I wasn't within earshot. Star. I can banter with the best of them, but there's a line, and when it's crossed, it's crossed. Star. The advances heightened, an inappropriate word here, a hand casually placed on my thigh, there. descriptions of fantasies that involved me. Star. I tried my best to avoid him. If I saw him in the elevator, I would take the stairs. If he was in the coffee room, I did without coffee. Star. I didn't want to make a fuss. Star. I worked hard to make the place a success. Star. One day I was called into his private office. He closed the door and said, "If you don't start having a drink with me after work, you will get nowhere in this company." Star. I should have known something was up when he sent his assistant to another room. Star. He pulled a key out of his desk and told me he had access to an apartment near the office that we could use. Star. I tried to find a way to say I wasn't on the same page without making him feel defensive. Star. I was hoping I could bluff my way through my discomfort. Star. I was the lowest paid admin in the company. I should have been paid more based on my experience and education. Star. But I needed my job. Star. I provided for my children, and thus the responsibility outweighed the self-preservation. Star. All of these issues combined to create a recipe for disaster. Star. One day he came over to my desk, cornered me, grabbed me, and started kissing me. Star. When I protested, he laughed and insinuated that I had been flirting and asking for it. Star. He shoved his groin into mine, so I pushed him off me as hard as I could, yelling no. Star, he said, no means yes, and kept putting his hands on me. Star. My whole body shut down. Star. He was in a sexual rage, like a wild beast fighting for what he wanted. Star. I felt small and helpless. Star. He looked at me, smiled, and shrugged, and simply said, "What can I do? Men will be men." Star. He left. I cried. Star. I was so ashamed, so sure I'd somehow invited his advances. Star. I didn't know what to do, because he could have easily fired me if I had said anything. Star. But when the shock wore off, the anger sat in. Star. What I didn't know is that he had some sort of harassment history that had been going on for years. Star. No one would step forward. Star. I reported the situation to our HR department, and a corporate investigation ensued. Star. I was so young and so naive. Star. I thought they would thank me and fix everything. Instead, they labeled me a troublemaker and silenced me. Star. My direct supervisor told me word for word, "You're just going to have to get over this because much worse things will happen in your life." Star. The people in charge had no desire to enact change. It was all smoke and mirrors. Star. They asked me to resign from my position until the situation could be resolved. I never unresigned. Star. One person can take only so much abuse. Star. Today, this man is the general manager of our company. He has risen and kept rising. Star. It took months before I became confident again, and weeks before I could let my boyfriend even touch me without crying from shame and guilt. I felt like I was nothing. Star. I just shared this story with my now 20-year-old college daughter, and she said, "Mom, why did you stay silent?" Star. Sometimes it's just the expectation that nothing will change. Star. In retrospect, this was the first time I was handed the knowledge that my gender would always precede me into a room and would be the thing I am judged on before all else. Star. My heart still hurts when I think too much about it, but I am so proud of the strong women who are standing up and telling their stories. Star. Change will not come from silence. And from this story written across this map of the United States, which has been contributed to by 50 different women, we have a list of initials and all the states of the Union. Our next contribution is called Living Out Loud. The woman who started a movement and how hashtag you too can keep it going. Tarana Burke has never been one to run from a fight. She says, quote, "I got into trouble a lot as a kid, usually for standing up for other kids. Once I was suspended from high school for leaving the building to get food for a pregnant girl. My mother would say, 'Mind your business, that has nothing to do with you.' But my line of thinking was that when there's a problem, you do what it takes to fix it." End of quote. Years later, while working in an Alabama youth program, Burke met girls who'd been sexually assaulted but didn't have the language to discuss what they'd experienced. She says, quote, "They weren't saying I've been raped. It was more like, I don't want to go home because my mom's boyfriend is always touching on me. I had my own experiences with sexual abuse and was trying to figure out what healing looked like." End of quote. Realizing that clarity and a sense of community were what she and these girls needed most, Burke eventually founded a nonprofit and referred to her movement as Me Too. In 2017, when hashtag Me Too caught on as a rallying cry, the hashtag was tweeted nearly a million times in just 48 hours and catapulted us to where we are today. Inspired, Burke says you can spark change too. And here are three bullets. You know that 50-page employee handbook you've never read? Get together with some coworkers and review your company's sexual harassment policy. Knowledge is the beginning of power. And the second bullet. Do you let your friends tell rape jokes? Don't. Good men and women are complicit in allowing this culture to thrive. We all should interrogate our roles. And our third and final bullet. If you have cash to spare, donate to any of these organizations which aim to empower and support women and girls. National Women's Law Center, Girls for Gender Equity, the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence, End Rape on Campus, and of course, the Me Too movement. We have a quote here from Jessica Valenti, author of most recently Sex Object, a memoir. What people need to understand about Me Too is that it's a revelatory moment for men, not women. We've always known how bad things are. And our next contribution is called Unzipped, an expert exposes the complex psychology of men who harass. Every man who acts out sexually has his own unique psychological history and challenges, but there are common patterns. Some men didn't get the love and security they needed when they were growing up, so they're expressing their depression and anger physically, as males are more likely to do. They're sexualizing unmet emotional needs. Others are afraid of being dominated by women. As boys come of age, they get the message that they can't be sissies, that a boy's defining powers lie in sports or aggression or sex. They have to distance themselves from their mothers, whom they associate with vulnerability. When they objectify a woman, they're saying, "I don't need you to take care of me. I can make you meet my needs on my terms." I've also seen many men who behave this way, in part because they feel powerless at home. They say their wives control their day-to-day lives or constantly criticize them, yet these otherwise powerful guys are unable to confront their spouses. When men act out, women often think their job is to cope. They're socialized to understand, work around, and find solutions. But not every situation can be analyzed and rationalized away. The answer is not for women to be more fearful of men, but to be more trusting of themselves. And that's from Alan Gratch, PhD, clinical psychologist and author of If Men Could Talk. Next, we have a quote from Margaret Atwood, author of the landmark feminist dystopia, The Handmaid's Tale. Over the past 200 years, women have been redefining what it is to be a woman, but the redefining of what it is to be a man has not kept up. For the Me Too moment to last, men and boys have to be included in the conversation, and not just by telling them they are evil and vicious by nature. They are not, any more than women are bitches, witches, or feeble, fainting violets. But men must work at making the changes in their own self-descriptions in order to improve things for women. Only then can boys will be boys transform into real men don't sexually assault. The next contribution is called May Cause Side Effects. Employment lawyer Allison West examines the flip side of progress. The backlash was inevitable. Managers and employees are now questioning their every workplace interaction. One male law firm partner told me, quote, "What exactly is unlawful harassment? Can I touch someone on the shoulder to show compassion? What if I compliment a colleague's new haircut?" End quote. He goes on to say, "I travel for business. Now I can't travel with a female associate. What if she sues me for something I said innocently?" End of quote. While some think that separating men and women will help them escape harassment claims, it could actually lead to a discrimination claim. Avoiding women isn't the solution. Having collaborative workforces where people have equal opportunity is. And our next contribution is called Sleeping with the Enemy. "We're not all bad," men say, "but what about the one who shares your bed?" A psychologist weighs in. For a woman in an intimate relationship with a man, all these harassment stories can open up a Pandora's box. What's really going on between us or in his private world? Who are men? Should I even have sex with a man? We're triggered in deep, body-based ways and, as people tend to do in highly emotional situations, we may break down into a black and white mindset. We start to think of our partner as a capital M man, rather than a human being with his own history and struggles. Yes, male sexuality can be highly objectifying, but most of the men I see in my practice want to have loving relationships, just like women do. I have empathy for men because integrating this importunate, intense sexuality with the need for love can be very demanding developmental and psychological task. We're all intricate, paradoxical people, not cardboard cutouts, and our ongoing challenge in our relationships and the culture is to fight the urge to seek absolutes. The question we should always come back to is, can I see this person's humanity? That's from Daphne de Marneff, PhD, author of The Rough Patch, A Marriage and the Art of Living Together. Our next contribution is from Debbie Daugherty, PhD, a professor of communication at the University of Missouri who studies sexual harassment. And it's entitled, "See Something? Say Something." Men primarily created this problem, and they need to take responsibility for it. When they see harassment, they can't dismiss it as dude stuff and look the other way because they like the guy or he has a family to support. The reality is many harassers are not one-time offenders, and by not reporting, you set the stage for them to repeat the behavior with new targets and cause even more damage. There is no such thing as an uninvolved bystander. Bystander intervention for both men and women should be part of workplace sexual harassment policies. As they say in the University of Missouri's athletics program, you see it, you hear it, you own it. And next, take back your might. Women are prone to imposter syndrome, self-doubt, the fear of being exposed as a fraud. Instead of attributing their success to hard work and talent, they tend to credit luck or timing. A woman who's been harassed may be adding perverse favoritism to this list as well. I would tell her that just as she needs to reclaim her power, she needs to reclaim her accomplishments. Even if a harasser helped you get your foot in the door, you stayed because you proved you deserved to be there. Both imposter syndrome and sexual harassment involve shame. Shift the shame back to where it belongs, on the harasser. That's from Valerie Young, author of The Secret Thoughts of Successful Women. And here's a quote from Phoebe Robinson, star of Two Dope Queens. I am beyond thrilled that the de-peening, or the most people have been calling it the reckoning, is happening. It should have begun long ago, but we still have a ways to go. We have to believe women when they speak their truth. More specifically, we have to believe women of color, because the Me Too movement was started more than a decade ago by a black woman, but didn't gain the traction it has now until famous women of a certain type latched onto it. So my hope going forward is that not just women of a particular race and class are heard, but all of us are. That those who were at the forefront of this movement are not forgotten or ignored. And that we, and by we, I mean everyone, take care of all of us. This is just the beginning, and I'm proud to witness it. And next we have a quote from Gretchen Carlson, journalist and author of Be Fierce, Stop Harassment and Take Your Power Back. We need to end the misogynistic corporate cover-up culture of enablers, which too often allows victims to be silenced and harassers to stay in their jobs. We must fix laws that force women into the secret chamber of arbitration when they're harassed, and give them back their constitutional right to a public trial if they choose. We are witnessing a revolution for women, just like getting the vote and entering the workforce, and there's no going back. And the next contribution is Can You Hear Us Now? We need hard accountability mixed with radical grace and actionable solutions. We can't just exile some guys to an island and say, those ones are duds. For starters, men should listen to the women in their lives. I tell college-age boys to call their girlfriend, sister, or mom and say, I love you, and I want to know what your experience as a woman has been like. Guys text me afterward and say, whoa, my girlfriend thinks I'm the best. Well, yeah, welcome to communications. That's from Alexis Jones, founder of the organizations I Am That Girl and Protect Her. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you.